morning, Dr. James Oliver, a retired physician and urologist of Moorhead, Minnesota, who today marks the 40th anniversary since he opened practice in Moorhead, Minnesota. This is May 15th, 1985. Dr. Oliver, will you tell us about your early years, your home, your education, and medical training?
Thank you, Dr. Holton. I was born April 20th, 1918 in Culm, North Dakota, which is a small town south of Jamestown. We moved to Fargo as a family in 1933. I was educated at Fargo Central High School, North Dakota State University, where I got my B.S., and then went to the University of North Dakota for 2 years in medicine, followed by 2 years at Northwestern University in Chicago. After that, I had a residency of 9 months, which was all the residencies that were allowed at that time during the war, in general surgery at Swedish Covenant Hospital in Chicago. Following that, because of physical disabilities, I was deferred insofar as my military duties were concerned. Consequently, came to Moorhead in 1945 to open a practice, as Dr. Holton stated, 40 years ago today. I was married in 1943. We have two children, both daughters. One, Susan, is now a psychiatrist practicing in Boulder, Montana. The other is a dental hygienist who's in practice in Los Angeles. I practiced in general practice, which I thoroughly enjoyed, from 1945 to 1955, at which time Uncle Sam called, and I was brought into the Army as a physician, sent to Germany, where we lived for 2 years, Swabish Hall, and following that came back into family practice in 1957. Until 1960. In 1960, I went into urological training at the University of Minnesota in the Veterans Hospital there for 3 years, following which I returned to Fargo and practiced for 2 years at Dakota Clinic, period. After this two-year period, Dr. Seifert and I joined forces in the old white building in downtown Fargo, the practice of urology. Practice continued until my retirement in 1981, period.
Jim, how was it that you chose medicine as a profession, and what do you recall of any particular anecdotes of your professional education?
It was very interesting because in 1939, when I graduated from North Dakota State University, then known as the Agricultural College, I had not decided until probably about a month before graduation as to what field I was going to go in. I was very interested in the sciences, had taken 4 years of zoology, all the chemistry, bacteriology, physics, and whatever was required in those days as a pre-medical student, but I was really interested in getting involved in being a naturalist, and for some reason, I think because of the coercion of some of my teachers, particularly Dr. Whedon at the North Dakota State University, who was at that time head of the Department of Zoology, who stated that he could get me a fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania, which he tried and I think was successful at. However, because of the cost involved, we felt it was much more expedient and financially advisable to go to the University of North Dakota Medical School, which incidentally we were able to go through in the usual 2 years for a total expense of $1,200. $500 the full year, that includes room, board, laundry, tuition, everything, transportation, and $700 the next year. It was almost humorous to recount that, in retrospect, that leaving the the beautiful environment of the University of North Dakota campus after 2 years. To get to Northwestern, where the tuition at that time was $1,500 alone. While at the Northwestern University, I was working, as many of us did, for room, board, and laundry at a hospital, which was good experience, a little hard on the sleep, but nevertheless educational, and that's after all what we were after. While at the working as a student, externing as it was called in those days, I became interested in the field of urology because one of the members of staff, Dr. Gernon, was a very pleasant, informative gentleman who was doing the urological work at the hospital. He had trained at the University of Illinois under Kretschmer. And he interested me immensely in the field of urology, although at that time I could not see getting involved in further educational endeavors because I already had a family and I was in dire need of making some money and getting involved in a more practical aspect. And consequently, I went into general practice, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But as all of us in Moorhead at that time, generally overworked. As a result, our families suffered because of our continual absence.
Jim, you were raised in Fargo, and you chose to return to this area and locate in Moorhead. Tell us why you made that choice and where your offices were in those early years.
When we came home in March of 1945, we were driving along in our 1937 Oldsmobile, which had a bad rear main bearing, which restricted our speed to 35 miles an hour all the way from Chicago. When my wife saw this area, we were in the midst of a flood, the usual spring flood. The water at that time was up to almost the level of the old First Avenue North Bridge, and the fields around Sabin were entirely inundated. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. She was terribly depressed by this flat country, and being from Pennsylvania, could hardly tolerate existing in this environment. Consequently, we looked around at various cities in Minnesota. We went to Bemidji, went to Detroit Lakes, and several other towns, Wadena, and to evaluate the potential of practice in these various communities. However, at that time, Dr. Bottleson in Moorhead had had surgery, and Dr. Gosley, unfortunately, at the time that I came, was in his last days as a patient in the hospital at St. John's. And therefore, there was an opening in Moorhead. There were no such great openings in the city of Fargo, which was getting more and more specialized. And we liked the idea of coming to Moorhead, which is a smaller community. People who were practicing medicine here were fine gentlemen as well. And we felt that this would make a lovely place to start. Early days of practice here, from 1945 to 1955, were tremendous. All of us as physicians got along beautifully. We had a home at St. Ansgard, which was second to none. The sisters were not only gracious, but hospitable. They were generous. They were constantly trying to service physicians' needs for equipment, for whatever laboratory x-ray services they could. They were just unusually fine, accommodating people. They were totally dedicated Christians and gave 100% of themselves to their patients and to whomever came under their wonderful care. During those early days, from 1945 to onward, those doctors who were here in Moorhead were Dr. E.W. Humphrey Sr., Dr. Jim Duncan, and Fred Thysel, the latter two being in partnership and practicing downtown Moorhead, as was Dr. E.W. Humphrey. Dr. Olga Holy Johnson was here, seeing in her home on South 5th Street. From Barnesville, Dr. Simonson and Dr. Seitz. From West Fargo, Dr. Coolin. And we had also two specialists who helped us greatly during those times, Dr. Joe Schneider in OBGYN and Dr. Art Burt in General Surgery. All of the doctors in Fargo Harbor were very cordial and very cooperative and would come over and see patients for us whenever we felt their need, period. These included Dr. John Bond and Dr. Bill Long, and whatever orthopedic problems we had, we referred either to Dr. Fortin or to Dr. Swanson, who did their work mostly at St. Luke's and St. John's Hospital, period. In those days, we had the weekend coverage. There were later on about six of us who covered the weekend calls, but initially, when we were first here, we were constantly on call for our own patients night and day and on weekends. And this got to be rather old hat in a hurry, and after about 4 or 5 years of this sort of thing, some of us, and I think Dr. Duncan was the instigator of this, we developed this weekend coverage, which I'm sure saved us many a headache and probably prevented a lot of coronaries amongst us, since the schedule was very strenuous and due to the fact that house calls, unfortunately, were a part of the total picture. And I recall when I was in family practice that I was making as many as 1 to 7 house calls a day. And was constantly being bothered on weekends by people who would come up to the house with their disabilities, either their children's cuts or bruises or something, and that would require bringing them up to the hospital, where we really didn't have any emergency room in those early days, but just sort of a place up in general surgery. In fact, it was one of the small operating rooms where many of the cystoscopies, fractures were set, and this was the emergency room, which was located then on the third floor, and taking these patients up on that old elevator, which was manually controlled, and which had a tendency to scare most of us out of our wits, even though we were used to it, I'm sure it didn't do much for the patients, who I can't recall any of them having enjoyed that trip particularly, period. I will say that the doctors that were here from 45 to 55, as well as those who came later, were doctors who, in general, were of the highest quality, the highest integrity, and were wonderful associates. I can't recall a single instance during all these years where one refused to help the other. I remember delivering many patients for doctors who were practicing out of town, who couldn't make it in time, and they did in return many favors for us along the same lines. In those days, there were many obstetrical patients, and St. Ansgard was delivered a considerable number of patients. I can't recall the number, but I'm sure considerably over 1,000 a year. And I felt strongly that the patients in those days received the ultimate of nursing care. Unfortunately, I recall when my wife had her second baby at St. Ansgard Hospital, she was not allowed out of bed at all for 10 days after delivery. An incident along that line is enlightening in that one day after my wife had been about 5 or 6 days postpartum, she had to go to the bathroom, and the nurses were not available, and I had instructed her never to bother the sisters while they were in mass. And so consequently, she got up and went to the bathroom and came back. And when Sister Alice found out about this, she was infuriated that she would dare to get out of bed on only her 5th or 6th day postpartum. My, how things have changed. And insofar as the practice of medicine was concerned, the office fees when I started were $2, house calls were $3. obstetrical care, or confinement as it was called in those days, was $35. It was unbelievable that what some of the doctors had gone through in their obstetrical care, having been involved in home deliveries, which I refused to participate in, and which fortunately was becoming passé when I started practicing in 1945. I remember one incident where Dr. Fred Thysel told me that during the spring of the year, when the roads were in a terrible mess and the fields were full of water, a farmer called him and told him that his wife was in labor. And Fred says, "Well, I can't very well get out to your place, so why don't you bring her to the road," which was tarred at that time, "and I'll meet you there." So he went out to the designated rendezvous site, and here he saw the farmer with his wife coming across the field in a manure spreader drawn by horses. And he got to the designated place, and Fred Thysel said, "Well, she's not going to make it any further than this," and he delivered the baby in a manure spreader. Now, that's a very interesting experience in those days, and fortunately, nothing untoward happened either to the mother or the child.
You witnessed some medical epidemics that was gone by the time I entered the scene. Why don't you tell us something about polio and the other infectious disease epidemics that you saw?
Yes, the great epidemic around here, I think in the latter 40s, I think 48 or 49, as I recall, was the polio scare, and we had many, many cases of polio. The iron lung, the Sister Kenny treatments, all those were in vogue. Many patients with bulbar paralysis did not make it. Many patients had unbelievable sequelae. In the midst of all this, I made a house call and saw a young 6 or 7 year old girl who had nuchal rigidity, that is stiffness of the neck, and all the typical classical signs of polio. Hospitalized her at St. John's, and had my friend Dr. William Armstrong see her in consultation as well, because the spinal fluid examination was entirely normal, which is rather unusual for polio. And we were baffled until the next morning when we went in to see the patient. We saw the sardonic grin that's characteristic of tetanus, and consequently she was treated and recovered from a rather severe case of tetanus. But it was unusual that to find this case that initially paralleled the clinical symptomatology and findings of polio. Poliomyelitis was a very dreaded disease. We were all very much afraid of it, regardless of the age bracket, but particularly for all of our children. And in those days, prior to the immunization techniques that are available now, it was a very frightening, a very tragic thing. It was unbelievably devastating to not only to the patient, but to the family and to their finances as well. So far as any other contagious diseases were concerned, we did see a lot of scarlet fever initially in the latter 40s. I don't recall ever seeing a case of diphtheria, although one of the other doctors had a case of diphtheria at that time. Typhoid fever was pretty well out of the picture insofar as any local cases were concerned, although there may have been several in the area. I don't recall any that either my friends or I had at that time. There were a multitude of the other contagious diseases, and at that time we had a contagious disease hospital in Fargo, which is a designated place, is now occupied by the Cass County Social Services Department. At that time, however, in the late 40s, it was used solely as a confinement place for people who had scarlet fever and other communicable diseases which required isolation. severe measles, as well as scarlet fever, polio at that time. Well, most of the cases later were involved in larger hospitals in the treatment of were treated in the larger hospitals because of the facilities, the iron lungs, the Sister Kenny hot bath, hot towel treatments, and so forth. I remember Dr. Duncan telling me that he and Fred Thysel had done mastoidectomies in that old contagious disease hospital because of the need, this being one of the complications that was seen in those days prior to the availability of any antibiotics of any kind. Incidentally, insofar as some of the antibiotics were concerned, we had the sulfonamides, the sulfa drugs, so-called, in the latter in 45 when I came to practice, but penicillin did not become available right away. It was being used solely initially during the war by the Army, and I think all the lots went to the Army for their consumption during the war. Later on it became available, and initially it became available in rather limited doses. In fact, 300,000 units at that time was considered a walloping dose, and we without hesitation would give it to patients on house calls, in the office, without any fear of anaphylactic reactions or any untoward reactions, because the populace at that time was not sensitized to penicillin as it later became. Consequently, it was a drug of choice. It worked in beautifully in most of the cases, and it was truly a godsend to all those that were involved with communicable diseases, to eliminate complications, to the usual tonsillitis, to pneumonias, and so forth. It was a wonderful addition to the physician's armamentarium.
What did you do for blood in those early years?
In those early days, we were fortunate because the hospital belonged to the War Memorial Blood Bank. Blood was available, but not with the great ease that it is now available today. This was the fact that the Rh factor, an unknown quantity insofar as we were concerned as physicians in the latter 40s, became known, as I recall, in the early 50s, and made transfusion much safer for the patient, and particularly for those in the childbearing era. Of interest, because talking about those early days insofar as hospitalization is concerned, patients that were hospitalized had the services of the radiologist, and we also had the services of a pathologist who also was located at Faro Clinic, namely Dr. Lamar, who would read all our tissues and advise us relative to any laboratory procedures, including transfusion reactions and so forth. Sister Bernice took care of the X-ray department, she took care of the laboratory, and she also was in charge of medical records. And even in those days in a small hospital, that was an overburdening task. I'd like to just say a few words about the practice in those early days as far as a hospital was concerned. We were a closely knit group as far as the all those involved in the care of the patients. That means the nurses, the aides, the physicians. We tried to help one another. We were one large, relatively happy family. And I will say that those years were beautiful years of human relationships, of interpersonal relationships, of doing the best we could for one another. And I treasure those years a great deal. And I think that's an era which will never return, because there are growth factors involved because of increased population in this area, increased needs and so forth, which tend to impersonalize relationships that once were quite close, period.
For the urology. Jim, you have covered well the practice of medicine from 1945 until You left for postgraduate training in 1955. Then tell us about your training in specialty training in urology and your return here following its completion.
The years spent at Minneapolis were just wonderful. It was like being reborn again in a medical sense. Affiliation with younger medical people, the influence of the University of Minnesota Medical School, exposure there with the urological staff, particularly Dr. Creevy, who was head of the department, and as fine a gentleman and urologist as I ever hoped to see, and Dr. George Mellinger, who was our chief at the VA hospital in Minneapolis, who was also in the similar vein, an outstanding gentleman and urologist. These people were tremendous teachers, and it was a privilege and a pleasure to be associated with them. Those years went rapidly. They were years that were enjoyed. Even the family enjoyed them very much. Our oldest daughter, Susan, graduated from Washburn High School down there, and Kathy, our younger daughter, finished Ramsey Junior High there. Susan took her college work then at the University of Minnesota, got her PhD in human genetics there at the University of Minnesota, and then went through medical school there, and as stated previously, is now practicing in Boulder, Colorado. Kathy graduated from Morehead High when we came back, and then proceeded to go to the University of Minnesota as well, and went into dental hygiene, and is now practicing in Los Angeles. Upon the completion of her residency, we came back to practice in Fargo with the Dakota Clinic. That time they had no urologist, Dr. Jack Burton having left the clinic and went to practice in Louisiana. I was there for 2 years and then decided to join Dr. Richard Seifert down town Fargo in the practice of urology. Those years of from 1965 to 1981 were enjoyable years in the field of urology, although I must say that I miss general practice. Being a consultant is a world apart from being involved in the family practice insofar as family relationships are concerned, and the beauty of the association with families, watching the children grow, having delivered the children, taking care of their needs, being part of the family, in a sense, is a beautiful part of family practice that I thoroughly missed. The urological aspect was challenging. It was rewarding. It was always exciting, and it was a specialty which I felt was one that was capable of rendering a great deal of service to the patient.
Dr. Oliver, will you tell us something about your community activities, your church relationship, and your close relationships around town that you've developed over these 40 years?
We belong to the First Congregational Church in Morehead since 1946. Incidentally, it was interesting because when we were in Sweden a couple years ago, we were investigating my wife's Swedish background, since both of her parents had come from Sweden. And so we were in Växjö. We went to the Swedish Museum, and there found that her name appears in the records there as being the offspring of Samuel J. Larsen, who migrated to this country in 1893, I believe it was. And incidentally, on the record was a fact that of our marriage and the fact that we had joined the First Congregational Church in Morehead in 1946. So there's very little you can hide in this world, even though you may desire to. Insofar as service clubs are concerned, I was a member of the Kiwanis Club of Morehead for 10 years. After returning a service in 1957, I did not rejoin. Unfortunately, thereafter, to my regret, because of scheduling problems with surgery and so forth, I did not re-enter the field of these service clubs, which I feel do a tremendous job for the community. Life in Morehead has always been of interest and rewarding. We've been very fortunate here not only to have Concordia, but Morehead State University as well, and North Dakota State University. The involvement with these, I remember being the physician who sat on the bench at most of the football games when I first came here in the early in the latter 40s. That was a beautiful experience. Being the team physician had its many rewards as well as many of its headaches. The involvement with the schools in as far as the health office is concerned was also shared by about Comstock Halls were there. It was an interesting arrangement. Unfortunately, later on, when Bellard Hall was built, the health services moved over there, and Miss Lindgren, who is Miss Lindquist, who was the nurse at Morehead State for many, many years, was just a tremendous person, and she gave the ultimate in care to those students under her supervision, and gave us as physicians the greatest possible accommodations. It was par excellent in fulfilling whatever requirements were needed for complete care of the student.
Dr. Oliver, you retired from the active practice of medicine 4 years ago. Will you comment about your retirement years and what this community has done for you and in your retirement?
Well, I've been fortunate after my retirement to be able to work during the summer several years at the VA hospital doing urological surgery. The last year, 1984, I worked for two mornings a week up there for 3.5 months, which was probably my swan song insofar as my involvement in active medicine is concerned. Insofar as this community is concerned, it is perhaps one of the greatest places to live in this United States of America. With the three colleges here, there is so much to do that one has to be very selective in participation, because otherwise one would be constantly on the run. Besides the great Fargo-Moorhead Symphony, we have had the activities at C400, the numerous activities of the Lyceum Series, the Artist Series at the various colleges, the sports programs, and the visiting dignitaries that have been here. The Comm University, which has been in itself an outstanding community project, period. My wife and I feel very strongly about this community. While we have been leaving for 3 to 4 months in the winter to escape the shoveling of snow and the bitter cold, we nevertheless have maintain a residence here because of our many friends and because of the opportunities that the community offers. Being involved in many of the sports programs insofar as a participant is concerned, golf, tennis, so forth, the Morehead Country Club, and the constant interest of the medical profession have been things that have been of great value and treasured by both my wife and myself.
Thank you, Dr. James Oliver, for a review of the 40 active years of the professional practice of medicine in Morehead, Minnesota. This is Dr. John Holden signing off.